Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Three Bid League podcast preseason preview here in the A-10. As always, it's a very optimistic episode as we look forward to the upcoming seasons for St. Louis, UMass, and LaSalle. Although St. Louis fans, as I'm sure many of you have seen on Twitter, they might not feel like it's too overly optimistic, but I promise you, I feel pretty good about the Billikens this year. However, we're going to start things off on a little bit more of a disappointing note. Matt, I think it was kind of a heartbreaker for both of us to see that Nick Sherrod tore his ACL last week in practice. Richmond has lost their best shooter for next year. And it appears that Sherrod will not be coming back the season after and that his college basketball career is over.
Well, Tyler, first thing I want to say, we're already going there with the St. Louis stuff. I just want to mention, I thought our first episode, which you should all go back and watch, it was Richmond, George Mason, and GW. I thought it was extremely fair. That's all I want to say. And we're going to keep this one fair as well. But you're right. I was so disappointed to hear about Nick Sherrod. He was great for Richmond last year. They really missed him when he got injured 2 years ago when he tore his other ACL. And it's a huge shame. The good news, if there is any, we talked about it in our preview, Richmond does have some pretty capable wings on the bench, but now we're going to need either probably Connor Crabtree or Tyler Burton step up. And, you know, I think they can do it. They're not going to be as good as Sherrod was expected to be. And I just really feel for him. As you mentioned, it sounds like his career is going to be over.
Yeah, he's been a fun player to watch. And unfortunately, we've seen his knee give out before. He missed an entire season. I guess it was 2 years ago now. And so second brutal leg injury for him in a span of 4 years. You really feel for a guy like that. But as for the Spiders, you know, losing Sherrod lowers their ceiling. It certainly lessens the chance of them having the type of season that like Jeff Goodman predicted, where maybe they could be a top 15 team in the country. But I'm not sure that it really hurts them all that much in their quest to be a top two team in the A-10 or be able to get an at-large bid. They got so many wings on the bench. You mentioned Crabtree and Burton. But Andre Gustafson was very good last year in a six-man role for them. They got a few very interesting freshmen coming in. And, yeah, Nick Sherrod was great. But for the first time in God, at least 5 years, they actually have the capability to replace him. And I think that they have a lot of guys who can kind of piece together what they're going to lose from Sherrod, but it'll hurt. It'll really hurt. There's not going to be any 6 3-point make games from Nick Sherrod anymore, but you know, on just a random Wednesday night, they might not feel this injury as badly as people think they will.
It's not a death sentence for their team by any means. Their depth is really good, and they have so many guys that can score. So they can survive this, and at least another silver lining. It's happening far enough in advance of the season that maybe they can prepare to play without him. Last year we saw Davidson really get in big trouble when they found out they lost Keyshawn Pritchett and Luke Frampton very early on in the year, and it took them a long time to adapt. So Richmond, they've got some time to figure it out. And I will say this does make the conference a little bit more interesting, or it makes it more open now, just because a lot of people had Richmond pegged as the favorite or the second best team. I still think they're one of those two top teams, but it's not quite as certain now since they are losing a starter.
Yeah, I've had a tier of top three teams back in April: Richmond, St. Louis, and St. Bonaventure at the time. I'm actively reevaluating as we go, and I still got to figure out where I'm going to put everybody in November. But
yeah,
even with Sherrod out, I'm still keeping Richmond in the top three. Like, this is not the kind of injury that's going to knock them off the top of the conference.
I would say, like, Richmond was one of the few teams I was confident in where I had them, and now that's kind of just out the window. But we'll see. I mean, they can be a good team. It's just, we hate to hear that, especially right after we did our preview pod talking about how great we thought they could possibly be. But anyway, before the team previews in this episode, I wanted to get to one more piece of news. Penn State, their head coach Pat Chambers recently announced his resignation amid some allegations that came out this summer. And so now the new head coach, at least for the time being, of the Nittany Lions, Jim Ferry. And Tyler, you're the Duquesne fan, so I mostly want to hear your opinion on this or just your thoughts. But I just want to add that, you know, after Jim Ferry was let go at Duquesne, I really did not see his next head coaching gig coming in the Big Ten. So this is a bit of a surprise, but I wish him the best for sure.
Let's just run over the timeline real quick here. So the Penn State job opens up at the end of last decade. They appear to be prepared to give the job to then Duquesne head coach Ron Everhart. Duquesne gives him a very, very nice extension, enough to convince him to stay. They hire Pat Chambers instead. Everhart doesn't even get close to finishing the extension before he gets fired and replaced with Jim Ferry, who was just honestly an out-and-out disaster at Duquesne. He just dug them into a deep hole after all the great work that Everhart did to really get them back on the map. And now, years later, it's Jim Ferry who ends up being the man to replace Pat Chambers on an interim basis at Penn State. It's interesting. You know, Ferry was a huge disappointment at Duquesne, but he showed a great ability to bring in talent. And this was after he showed an ability to win with lesser talent at LIU Brooklyn. So he's really shown both sides of the equation. He just simply never put them both together before. And, you know, it's fascinating. It makes me at least a lot more interested in the Big Ten this year.
I saw a couple tweets after that came out about Penn State fans wanting Anthony Grant to get hired. I'm smart enough at this point to know that a coach staying at a job forever is never a guarantee, but man, that would be quite disappointing. And I'm pretty confident that won't happen. We'll see though. Maybe
a huge step down.
Yeah, I would think so. I would hope so. Maybe Ferry can earn the job if Penn State's surprisingly good this year, but not too confident without knowing that much about the Big Ten or anything. But yeah, tough spot for them for sure.
And by the way, is all the Dayton fans panic about this, or not all, but a few got a little nervous. And then of course the next day we get the news that Dayton landed their first five-star recruit in school history. And you know, I just want to make this very clear. Anthony Grant is becoming an old man by coaching standards. He had a rough go at Alabama. He is back at his alma mater. He took them to what would have been a one seed had a normal season happened. I want to make it very simple. Like, I would be stunned if Anthony Grant leaves Dayton by choice for any reason other than retirement. I fully expect that he will be the Dayton coach for the next 20 years, unless he either gets fired or somehow gets like the Kansas job.
I hope you're right. I'm not going to go on the record saying that, but yeah, I think there's very few jobs that someone like him would leave for at this point. It's tough to leave your alma mater, although we did see it with Chris Mack a couple years ago, so you never know, but I would be surprised.
Yeah, and I want to talk about one more thing after that. After the news that Dayton landed a commitment from top 50 recruit LaRon Holmes, I saw a lot of people saying that they could be the next Gonzaga, and you know, to be able to do that is just so ridiculously hard. Mark Few taking a small school in the WCC and basically turning it into like Michigan State. Mm-hmm. We'll probably only see that once in our lifetimes, but Dayton could absolutely be the next Butler, a team that has just a great 1 or 2 year run, but they have a really good coach. They have a huge fan base and they bring in a lot of money. And I really do believe that they could be the kind of school that is just consistently a top 30 program for the next 15 years, which is basically what Butler is. Butler doesn't have any kind of advantage that Dayton lacks other than the fact that they're just in the Big East.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what Dayton fans have been wondering for most of the last 15 years or so. Like, why can't we be that team? And last year we finally caught a glimpse. So we'll see. But anyway, I want to move on to our team previews if you're ready. I think let's talk about a team that has those aspirations this year, someone that, you know, a lot of the analysts are very high on St. Louis. And, you know, I'm not necessarily one of those people, but I'm going to put that aside for the next 15 minutes or so. But yeah, I think if you're ready, let's get into our first team preview of the night.
Yep. And for those of you who did not catch our first episode, which, as Matt said earlier, very much worth going back and listening to, we're doing things a little differently this year. We're going to put 15 minutes on the clock for each team, just so we make sure that we don't spend far too much time on them. This is a soft 15 minutes, much like Pardon the Interruption. When the bell dings, we don't necessarily stop, but it's kind of a sign to wrap it up. And we also do either four or five key questions at the end of this, some that I've written up, some that Matt has written up, and some that we've gotten from the experts around those teams. And with that being said, we actually have six questions for SLU. So I'm going to go ahead and put 16 minutes on the clock. The Billikens get a bonus minute here. Maybe this will help to make the SLU fans like us a little bit more.
Yeah, that would be nice.
So here we go, starting it up. St. Louis Billikens come back after what many consider to be a super successful season. They managed to clinch a double bye on the final night of the year, blowing out St. Bonaventure. And they basically bring the whole crew back. Jordan Goodwin, Hassan French are back for round four. This is the final turn for those two stars. Yuri Collins comes back for his sophomore year. Javonte Perkins, Gibson Jimerson is healthy now. Jimmy Bell Jr. is a year older and more experienced. And you know what? This is a formidable foe.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, pretty much everyone coming back. The only guy of note that graduated was Tay Weaver. They lost a couple transfers from guys that weren't really in the rotation. First thing I think we have to mention, Jordan Goodwin and Hassan French really feel like those two guys that it's if you're not a fan of St. Louis, it's like, man, they've been at this school for 6 or 7 years. And they just continue to do their thing. They're both lockdown defenders. They can both pound it inside, score at the rim, and they both cannot shoot the ball at all. But it's so impressive. I believe I should have researched this before we started. I think they're the only pair of teammates in college basketball last year to each average a double-double. And there weren't very many individual players at all. So for one team to have two of these guys at the same time, that's pretty crazy. And when you add in the great or the solid supporting cast that St. Louis had last year, that's what led them to a fourth place finish. And overall, I think they were picked around seventh or eighth place in the preseason. So last year, Travis Ford and his Billikens had a really nice season.
We got to start with the single most consistent trio in this conference, French, Goodwin, and Travis Ford. And, you know, there's nothing flashy about any of those three guys, but man, do they get the job done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hassan French is probably the single most predictable player in this conference. We've really seen no changes from him over the last 4 years, just little incremental improvements here and there. We know he's going to get 12 to 14 points a game. We know he's going to get 10 rebounds. He's going to get a few block shots. He's going to be a defensive menace. He'll be at the end of the year in the conversation for second or third team all conference. He'll be in the conversation for all defensive team. And then his partner in crime, Jordan Goodwin, I would say he's probably the safest bet of anyone in this conference to make the first team at the end of the year, either him or Jalen Crutcher. And as long as those two stay healthy, there's no way St. Louis will be bad this year. And with the supporting cast they have, I'd be willing to say that with those two healthy, I don't see a way that they lose any more than six games in conference. I fully expect them to go 12-6 at the worst. But the other end of that sword is that, you know, there's not that much room for growth from either of these players. Maybe Goodwin becomes a better shooter. I've been on the side of, I believe he has the tools to do it. And when you really dig into the film, it almost seems like it's a mentally created hitch that's screwing him up. He's so much better of a rhythm shooter than he is when he thinks about it. But, you know, odds are these two guys are just going to basically look like the same players they were last year.
I think, yeah, Jordan Goodwin and Hassan French, as much as any players in the conference, they've pretty much done the same thing with steady improvement each year. But I think we pretty much know who they are at this point. And I don't see them improving too much on averaging double-doubles just because that would be really hard to do. And, yeah, if St. Louis is a team, if they improve like a lot of people are predicting, it's got to be the supporting cast. And they've got a lot of rising sophomores this year. Yuri Collins and Jimmy Bell Jr. were both pretty much full-time starters as freshmen. So I assume they're going to be getting a lot of playing time once again. And then I think where a lot of the real excitement lies in this team is that they return Gibson Jimerson and Fred Thatch, both from season-ending injuries, or in the case of Thatch, he had an illness. And those guys were both limited. They didn't even make it to conference play, unfortunately. But from all indications, it sounds like they're good to go and they're back practicing at full capacity. And that's what makes this St. Louis team really deep, and they've just got a lot of different options on the court.
Yeah, and not only does Jimerson come back, but I think we all keep forgetting that Fred Thatch is coming back too. Basically the polar opposite of Gibson Jimerson, a guy who cannot shoot whatsoever, but a fantastic defender. And I find myself thinking about the possibility of a Collins, Goodwin, Thatch, French, and I don't even care who the fifth guy is, lineup that could basically smother any team in this conference defensively. St. Louis should have the best defense in the A-10. Am I wrong in saying that?
It's going to be one of the top three, I would say. I mean, I think Richmond's going to be good again. I don't know why I'm thinking of this now, but Fordham, honestly, could be pretty good defensively. But yeah, St. Louis is going to be one of the top defenses again. I have no doubts about that. I really think where it gets a little bit more dicey is whether or not they can be one of the more consistent offensive teams in the conference. But defensively, and especially with their great rebounding, that's not really a big area of concern for St. Louis.
Yeah, and you know, I guess we'll start the questions here because this leads perfectly into my first one, which is, what does Travis Ford have up his sleeve this year on offense? We know the standard St. Louis offense, this ground and pound. They're the basketball equivalent of Wisconsin Badger football. And basically against any team that they can overpower and that Travis Ford can outcoach, they're probably going to go undefeated in those games, regardless of what happens with the shooting. But we've seen them struggle against teams that can match their physicality 1 through 5, which right now I guess is basically just Duquesne and maybe Dayton. Although I'm skeptical about if Dayton's forwards can hang with Goodwin and Bell.
I agree with Duquesne, but yeah, I don't know about Dayton there. Didn't really work out last year.
Yeah, they'll struggle against Duquesne again. But other than that, they should be pretty good in games, except when Travis Ford just gets beaten to tarnation by the other coach. We saw Bob McKillop do it last year. We saw Anthony Grant do it in one of the games last year. And in a conference with so many great coaches, those two and Schmidt especially coming to mind, although Ford owns Schmidt weirdly, there's going to be nights where St. Louis needs to do something different, where the pounding the paint doesn't work and the shots aren't falling simultaneously. And in those situations, we've seen Travis Ford kind of just throw his hands up. For this team to be good, they don't need Ford to be that great. But for this team to be as great as the Billikens fans believe they can be, Ford's going to have to win them some games on his own.
I think this is where it gets a lot easier for Ford that they're bringing Gibson Jimerson back. Because that having him will allow St. Louis to have a lot more shooters on the court than they did last year. And really, I see three guys on this team that are proven as three-point shooters. It's Jimerson, Javonte Perkins, who we are definitely going to spend some more time on soon. And then I feel like a lot of people forget about Demarius Jacobs, but he was actually a 39% three-point shooter last year, albeit on pretty low usage. And then St. Louis also has a couple freshmen. Andre Lorenzen and Philip Russell both have reputations as shooters. I don't know how much they're going to play with the experience that the Billikens bring back. But we'll say right now, like, those five guys can shoot from the outside. And maybe, you know, Goodwin or Thatch improves. I think St. Louis needs to have two or three shooters on the court most of the time, at least two of those of that group, because otherwise you're just going to get a Davidson situation from last year where the defense is just going to pack it in and harass Goodwin and French inside and contest all their shots. I think if, you know, St. Louis can run a consistent lineup with Javonte Perkins and Gibson Jimerson out on the wings, keeping the defense honest and having to guard the perimeter, that just opens up the rest of St. Louis's offense so much more, and that would make it a lot easier for them to get looks inside. So that's what I'm looking for. If the Billikens can take full advantage of Gibson Jimerson's return as a three-point threat, and if Jimerson can repeat what he did at the beginning of last year, I think that would make Travis Ford's job a lot easier, and it would make it more difficult to completely shut St. Louis down, as a few teams were able to last year.
Look, I see no reason for them to stop playing Billiken ball. This may be the team that's most perfectly constructed to do what Travis Ford wants with Goodwin, French, Collins, and Perkins all together. And most nights it will work fine. But you hit the nail on the head. They have so many more options now. And, you know, Gibson Jimerson does not have to go make 5 3-pointers every night. But in that Davidson game last year, God, they could have used him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that's where there could be a difference this year, is in those tough games where things don't work out, you need Gibson Jimerson, you need Demarius Jacobs. But, you know, Demarius Jacobs shot great last year. He still didn't play that many minutes. He played so few that I kind of forget he exists half the time we talk about SLU. Although that might be my own dumb fault. He played 23 minutes a game, but still. With how badly this team needed shooting, it kind of says something that he wasn't at 30 minutes a night. And so I don't see the Billikens just going away from their identity, but they're going to have to rely on those pieces. And Travis Ford's going to have to show an ability to find different ways to use those guys, because he can't just trot them out like he did with, say, Tay Weaver and just hope that they find their way into an open three. That won't work. And on the tough nights.
Yeah, and I'm not saying St. Louis should just abandon Billiken ball. I mean, it's worked for them. Like, it's not pretty, but it's proven that it can work. They won an A-10 tournament doing that. I just think having those options would make it a lot easier. And, you know, I look at this team, they were 111th in the country in offensive efficiency. That's not going to be good enough to get them to the NCAA tournament like they're expecting, that might be good enough to make it to the tournament. That's not going to be good enough to advance in the tournament like a lot of their fans are expecting. The defense is solid, like we already said, but, you know, if they could get that three-point shooting better, which their three-point percentage as a team actually wasn't bad. They shot 34% as a team, but I believe they were the only team in the Atlantic 10 that made fewer than 100 three-pointers in conference play. So they just weren't taking very many at all. It wasn't a big part of their offense. If they could add that three-point shot to their strong inside game, then all of a sudden you could be looking at one of the scarier offenses in the conference.
You hit the nail on the head. It's not about the percentage. It's about the number of makes. Like, it's great, wonderful. You made 34% of threes as a team, but they basically they've made slightly over 5 a game. And on certain nights, it just doesn't cut it.
Right. So I kind of, for my question, kind of going on those lines with three-point shooting, we haven't talked about Javonte Perkins yet, really, and I think he honestly might be the most important player on this team just because of what he did at the end of last season. And I basically repeated this stat when we went on the House of the Rick Belt. Gosh, it feels like a year ago, but I think it was back in May. Javonte Perkins had a great first season with the Billikens, but I kind of look at his conference season, at least in two separate sections. The first 11 games, he had an effective field goal percentage of 48%, and he was very good. But the last 7 games, which is when St. Louis really took off, he was all the way up to 68.7% for his effective field goal percentage. And for reference, Obi was around 70% last year there, which was one of the best in the country. So Perkins was truly amazing. And if he does that again, if he can be more consistent with that, he would be one of the best, if not the best, offensive player in the conference. My question, though, you know, the first half of the season, Javonte Perkins, the first half of conference season, That's a great player, but I don't think he's good enough alone to carry the offense when St. Louis is struggling. And so I just want to know, which Javonte Perkins are we going to get this year? Was the last seven games an outlier, or is that something we can expect more of this season?
I think we end up seeing the guy that basically Javonte Perkins' averages showed us to be. So really kind of a half and half in between those guys. When you look back at what he did in junior college and in his senior year of high school, those numbers basically line up directly with what he ended up averaging across the full conference season. Mm-hmm. They're going to be a better offensive team this year with the shooters all around. And Perkins' usage rate most likely will end up shifting downward a little bit. So I don't think that we're going to see the same guy that we saw all throughout February. I'm just not even sure the opportunities will be there to see that guy. But, you know, what he did was not a fluke. And I certainly see him being able to do it in 5 to 7 games again this year. I don't think that there is enough opportunity or enough proof in what we've seen in the rest of Perkins' career to believe that he's going to do it in 12 games as opposed to 7.
Right. And it will be interesting to see if the opportunity is still there with St. Louis bringing in more guys. But toward the end of last season, they really needed him a couple of those times. And it was truly amazing to watch what he was able to do. I will say the reason I didn't really bring up his full season stats and I just talked about conference play, I'm pretty confident that he's going to be better than his full season indicated, just because there was a kind of difficult transition to Division I. His first, you know, 7 or 8 non-conference games, he really wasn't a huge factor on the Billikens. I kind of think at this point we can just throw that out and not worry about it, because he showed in the second half of last season that he's much better than the player that entered Shea Fitz Arena for the first time.
So you have him as your most important guy. I have a different player as my most important guy, and this leads into my second question. Is Yuri Collins going to play like an all-conference player this season? Because, you know, Goodwin and French and Perkins are the reason that this will be a really good team. But I don't really see a ton of pathways to improvement for any of them besides Goodwin becoming a better shooter. And so as I try to – wow, timer already went off. You know what? We're going to speed it up, but we're still going to finish the questions because this is too important of a team.
All right.
They have to find a way to get from good to great. And I think the easiest way is for Yuri Collins to clean up the turnovers and just become a maestro out on the court, become the guy who can find the little gaps when the defense is packing the paint on them and really allow them to play Billiken ball in any situation. So I ask you, can he be a potential all-conference guy this year?
Yeah, I think he's definitely got that potential. He had a couple of really great games last year. Super fun to watch. There's a reason a lot of people in this conference really love him. And his assist rate as a freshman was pretty crazy. I believe he did lead the country in assists as a freshman, which is very impressive by him, especially on a team that didn't shoot the ball all that well, so it's kind of harder to get assists. But you're right, the turnovers were a huge issue. He led the conference in turnover rate by a pretty big margin, I believe. I'm just not sure he's offensively there to be an all-conference player just yet, especially when you realize that there are a ton of great point guards in the A-10 right now. Because it wasn't really just the turnovers. He also just wasn't effective as a scorer either. He only shot around 37% on the season, which isn't great. One area, though, where he could maybe see some improvement, I do remember he dealt with some hand injuries last year, which maybe that affected his passing and ball handling. So assuming he's a little bit healthier this year, maybe he won't turn the ball over quite as much and he could improve as a shooter. But I don't know. I just feel like I think eventually Yuri Collins will be an all-conference player. For this year, just because of how many great guards there are in this league, I don't know. I think it's going to be a pretty difficult pass.
So I want to end that question on this. If St. Louis ends up being a nationally ranked team throughout the season this year, Yuri Collins is going to have a 2-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. I think that that's the biggest thing that can happen to them to help them take a step up.
What was his ratio last year? Do you have that?
It was 171 to 99. So he's actually not that far off, but he's going to, He's got to clean up the turnovers a little bit.
Sure. All right. Well, my question was more of us about Yuri Collins, my next one. So I don't know. I don't want to run too far over, but if you have anything else quick, we can do that before moving on.
Okay. So let's do the West Pine Bills questions real quick. They sent us two.
Okay.
So will the team pick up where they left off last season? How far can they go if that's the case? I'll start with this. Yeah, I think that the team we saw in the second half of the season is more indicative of what we're going to see next year. If that's the team with no market improvements, they probably finish third or fourth. They certainly get a double bye again, and they end up as a bubble team. If they find a way to take a step up, whether it's Goodwin or Collins or one of the young shooters, then this is certainly a team that can make the second weekend of the NCAA tournament, but there's going to have to be some improvement over last year for that to happen. But you know what? I think their floor, even if things become disastrous, I don't see this team finishing below fourth.
That's pretty much the reason why I think so many people are excited about St. Louis is the way they finished last season. I mean, just going through some of their late games, they blew out VCU. They went and won at Rhode Island. They killed St. Bonaventure on senior night. So they had some great games down the stretch. And I agree. If they pick up right where they left off, then they're going to the tournament. If they don't, then it gets a little more difficult. But, yeah, I mean, the way they finished the season, that's a big reason for the optimism, I think. And I do think, like, we're going to see more – what we see next year is going to be closer to what happened at the end of the season than maybe the beginning of conference play when things weren't running quite as smoothly.
Yep. So second question from them, how does a fully healthy Fred Thatch fit with the team? He was a starter before his injury last year and the team filled his role nicely. He's still a crucial player, but does Slew bring him off the bench or in the starting lineup? I think a healthy Fred Thatch just takes this amazing defense to even new heights. If he's healthy all year, I see them as the best defense in the A-10. But just given the way that he fits with Collins, Goodwin, and French all being non-shooters and him likely being a non-shooter again, although I do see that potentially improving. I doubt he starts. I see him coming off the bench. I see him playing upwards of 25 minutes a night and providing them great defense, but he makes more sense coming off the bench unless it's a situation where maybe you need him to guard, say, like a Marcus Weathers.
Yeah, I agree with what you said. Pretty much goes back to what I was talking about earlier with St. Louis's shooters. If Thatch actually improves as a shooter and he can hit him around 35% or so, then yeah, he could start. But if he's more of just a defensive stopper, I kind of feel like it would make more sense to bring him in off the bench. But either way, having him back, assuming he can stay healthy, that's going to be a big bonus to this team.
Yeah, you have to start either Jacobs or Jimerson to give you some shooting. And then against bigger teams, I assume that they will start Jimmy Bell because that he really helps their physicality down low.
Yeah.
So we went way over on St. Louis.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Well, we had still shorter than we went on VCU last year.
Yeah, after the controversial things I said about St. Louis earlier this offseason, which I do, I don't apologize for where I put them in my way too early rankings, but I do apologize for doing it without this full explanation. I tried to respond to as many tweets as I could, but got a little bit overwhelming that day. So yeah, we had to extend this one a little bit. Yeah, let's move on.
All right, so 15 minutes on the clock
for real this time.
Probably the team that I've seen in the most amount of spots in various different people's A-10 predictions, the UMass Minutemen. They bring back last year's Rookie of the Year, a potential superstar in Trey Mitchell. The veteran Carl Pierre's back for his final year. And a whole bunch of other key members of last year's freshman class, Preston Stantos and Colton Mitchell, great defenders for this team. TJ Weeks, the sharpshooter, comes back after they lost him to a season-ending injury in December. They pick up a very interesting transfer in the former Wichita State point guard Noah Fernandez, Faji Walker, among the guys who are back on their bench, and another interesting point guard choice in Javon Garcia. Hopefully someone will tell me how to properly pronounce that name.
8 players on this roster from Woodstock Academy. That's not a criticism at all. I just wanted to point that out. I'm really interested to see how that's going to work out. But we could say last year it was great because it brought them Trey Mitchell. It brought them TJ Weeks and Preston Santos. And now most of these newcomers are also from the same prep school. So I'm interested to see if maybe they have a little bit more team chemistry than you'd normally expect from a young team. But I think you're right that there is a ton of variance in what fans are expecting from UMass. I've seen them as high as 4th. I've seen them down in the pillow fight range. It's really hard to tell just how much they're going to improve. And I think one of the main keys for me that gives them maybe a higher ceiling than other teams is that they potentially have the best player in the conference in Trey Mitchell, who just took the conference by storm last year. He was fantastic in conference play. Ended up making it onto the all-conference second team, which I'd be pretty surprised if he didn't go up to the first team this year. I think that's a lot of the excitement. Anytime you have one of the best players in the conference, that gives you a chance to win on any given night.
This team has so many question marks when you look at the bench, and even when you look at the rest of the starting lineup around Trey Mitchell. But the simple fact of the matter is, if he takes a natural step up this season, then he is at worst one of the 3 best players in this conference. And in a league like this, when you have a guy like that, you're going to finish in the top half. And so it really stuns me that people have UMass as a potential pillow fight team. Like, if Trey Mitchell plays to his potential, I don't see them possibly finishing any lower than 7th.
So this was sort of one of my questions, which it wasn't really a detailed one anyway, but something we can just talk about it now. We've been really lucky the last 3 years in the A-10 to see some just truly remarkable freshman seasons. And what I'm wondering is Trey Mitchell going to be Kelvin Grady, where he just, you know, he's steady, he's really good, but he doesn't really improve much on his crazy freshman year? Or is he the guy we saw last year that suddenly won player of the year? Now, that's a lot to ask for, and I'm not suggesting that Trey Mitchell is about to be a lottery pick next year. But do you think he has that kind of potential? Because, you know, you don't see freshman seasons like that super often. I mean, we've had about one a year for the last few years now.
So basically, the Trey Mitchell range is anywhere from player of the year in this conference to he has a slight regression and ends up being like third team all conference. If I had to pinpoint it right now, I'd pick him first team all conference, but not as the player of the year. I think that we've basically seen who he's going to be on offense. He's a dominant low post player. He's a decent passer and a great rebounder. I don't really see that much of an improvement in his offense unless he becomes a better 3-point shooter. He was at 33% last year, really ramped up his attempts as the season went on. But I think in this day and age, there's only so much you can do with a dominant post-up guy. And unfortunately for UMass, I think they might have already hit the ceiling there. Now, granted, it's a beautifully high ceiling, but I don't see quite the same level of playmaking ability in Mitchell that Obi Toppin started to flash at the end of his freshman year. I think that's what's really going to kind of separate those two going forward. Now, as for Mitchell's ability to get better, he could certainly become a better defender. He's decent in the low post right now. He's a fine shot blocker, and he knows how to utilize his big body, but he's the kind of guy that can really get burned on switches right now. And, you know, right now I just kind of feel like he's an average defender. He certainly has the ability to be a very good one, and that's where the potential to take a leap is going to come in.
I'm glad you brought that up, because defense, really, both for Mitchell and the Minutemen as a whole, that's something I really want to hit on with this preview. Because I think sometimes, this is a theory I've kind of been thinking of recently, I feel like it can kind of be difficult to be a great defensive center when you're also your team's best offensive option, like by far. And I think we kind of saw that with Dayton last year. You didn't really see Obi Toppin contesting every shot quite as hard just because he couldn't get into foul trouble. And that wasn't an issue because Dayton had other great interior defenders. But I also think of Richmond 2 years ago when Grant Golden had to stay out of foul trouble and they sucked defensively. UMass was not very good on the defensive end. I think they were about 10th in the conference in defensive efficiency. And I don't think Mitchell's bad by any means, but I certainly also wouldn't compare him to Michael Hughes or Oshun Oshuni. So I think he's good, but I also think it's kind of a tough balance because he can't be picking up two fouls 8 minutes into the game either.
Yeah, he definitely can't because he's so critical on the offensive end for them. And, you know, that this is where Matt McCall's ability to set up his defenses can really help out. I think it was John Rothstein who put out their projected starting lineup for this year and didn't have Preston Santos in there. I'd be stunned if Preston Santos doesn't start because he's the guy, much like how Nathan Kao does for Richmond, Santos is the guy who takes the tougher low post defensive assignment for UMass. He's a fantastic young defender and a guy who very well could make an all defensive team here in the future. And if Matt McCall structures his defenses right, then Preston Santos should be the one who's taking the brunt of the difficult assignments. And that in and of itself should really help Trey Mitchell to stay out of foul trouble.
I think Preston Santos is one of these guys I'm most excited to see how he develops just because he had some really interesting stats. I mean, first off, he's a very good shot blocker. He got a lot of steals and overall one of the better defensive players on this team. Offensively, he was actually the most efficient player in the A-10, albeit at very low usage. But he was a 40% three-point shooter too, which for his height, that's really solid for them to have. So I'm interested to see what he does. Overall, I just think the supporting cast is what's most important to UMass because we know they have a star. They struggled for a bit when TJ Weeks got hurt early on in the season, and I think it took them a while to bounce back from that. But really, it's, you know, not to the same degree, but kind of like St. Louis, I think once they figured out their rotation a little bit more, the last 7 or 8 games, the Minutemen were a much different team than the beginning of conference play.
By the way, the UMass website has Preston Santos listed at 180 pounds. That can't be right.
I don't know. I mean, we'll see how he looks this year, I guess.
Unless he, like, really slimmed down, which, for the sake of this team, I hope he didn't.
Well, he's an interesting player because I think he can – I think they also might have him listed as a guard/forward. He can guard a lot of different positions, so –
He's more of a center than a guard at this point.
Yeah, I wouldn't really consider him a guard either, but I don't know. I think he's one of the more versatile players, and that's why I'm kind of interested to see if his usage goes up this year.
So was that your first question?
Kind of. I just kind of blended them all together, but yeah, we can roll with that.
Okay, so I'll go on to mine, which to me is basically the only question that I care about in trying to project where this team's going to finish. What is the ceiling for the top guys on this team? You have Trey Mitchell coming back. You have TJ Weeks, who, if he is healthy, is absolutely an all-conference talent, coming back. You have Noah Fernandez, who, you know, if you really want to listen to the biggest homers of the UMass fans, he could potentially be an all-conference player. So how good is the top of the roster for this team? Because if they have 2 to 3 all-conference caliber players, then it kind of doesn't matter how good the role guys are. That's a top 4 team.
See, I like TJ Weeks, maybe not quite as much as you. I'm not sure I'm ready to say he's all-conference level just yet. Trey Mitchell is for sure. I mean, we've said enough about him. But yeah, I think it's kind of like what we said about George Mason last week, how they already have one established star who can be the second guy. And TJ Weeks, I mean, he shot 48% from 3, just kind of a small sample size since he was limited to 10 games. So maybe he can keep that up. I'm really interested to see what Carl Pierre can do. I feel like a lot of people have forgotten about him just since he kind of fell off hard in conference play last year. He only shot around 29% from 3 during that stretch, but over his career, he's much closer to 40%. So if he can get back to where he used to be, I think that would be a huge boost. I don't know, though. I mean, I can't confidently say that UMass will have a second all-conference player, which I think is why I think they still have the high ceiling because of Mitchell, but I'm not confident in them reaching that ceiling either.
I'm all in on TJ Weeks as an all-conference player this year. I know we're mostly talking about hypotheticals in here, and we're kind of saving the predictions for later, but, you know, I rave about TJ Weeks all the time. He has one of the best shots that I've ever seen from a player in this conference, and if he is healthy, he is a guy who could very well be a 15 to 18 point a game player. Trey Mitchell almost certainly will be in that range once again. He was 17.7 last year. He actually probably has an even better chance of getting above 18. If you have two top 10 offensive options in this conference, then you're a double bye candidate. Now, I don't love what UMass's defense is going to look like, especially with those two and Pierre on the court together. But they should have a terrifying offense this year.
See, that's exactly my big concern with this team. I think they're going to be great on offense because you're surrounding Trey Mitchell with a couple outstanding shooters, and they're going to have a lot of guys that can score. But defensively, I'm worried, and this leads me into one of my biggest questions for this team. UMass, they're not quite VCU levels of havoc, but they ran a press a decent amount last year. I wasn't terribly impressed. I mean, they really, as a team, they weren't that great at forcing turnovers for the amount of time they used to press. Do you think that can get better this year? Because what I'm thinking is they've got TJ Weeks back. He's got a lot of length at guard. He can force some steals. Noah Fernandez was part of an outstanding Wichita State defense, albeit in limited minutes, but he's another good defender. Do you think Matt McCall and UMass can get that press working a little bit better and force a little more havoc on defense?
I think, honestly, when you talk about the press especially, a lot of that's going to come down to how much does Colton Mitchell play this year. I absolutely love him on defense. He's one of the best perimeter stoppers in this league, but he was not good on offense. I think that's really the nicest way to say it. If Fernandez and Garcia play to their potential, then I kind of start to wonder if Colton Mitchell's going to struggle to get on the court. I'm very nervous about this defense. I think it probably comes down to the same three guys that I just talked about on offense. Can one of the three, at least between Trey Mitchell, TJ Weeks, and Noah Fernandez, be an above average to really good defender? Because those three are going to play a lot of minutes for them this year. And if they're getting below average to average from all three of them, they're in a lot of trouble on that end. There's only so many messes that Preston Santos and Colton Mitchell are going to be able to clean up. You throw in Carl Pierre too, who's never been a particularly fantastic defender. Mm-hmm. They're going to need one of their stars to become a two-way star.
Yeah, I think UMass's shaky defense is actually what I think gives Colton Mitchell still an important role on this team, despite him not doing a whole lot offensively. I think his lack of shooting ability makes it more likely that Noah Fernandez is going to get the lion's share of the minutes at point guard, just because he's a little bit more of a complete player right now. But Mitchell's still got a role. And since we're talking about point guards, this is where I need to mention disgraced UMass women's tennis booster Curry Hicks Sage really wanted us to talk about Javon Garcia, who he's got a high ceiling. A lot of UMass fans are super excited about him. And unfortunately, I didn't get to do my homework that much, kind of in a time crunch today. But right before we hopped on this call, I watched some film of him. What I love about Garcia is that, you know, a lot of UMass's offensive threats mainly do it through three-point shooting, but Garcia is a lot better just driving to the basket and finishing, and he's also bigger. He's around 6'3". So compared to Noah Fernandez, who's only 5'11", he's kind of too small to finish at the rim consistently. I feel like Garcia might be a little bit better at just creating for himself, which that makes him an exciting player. Unfortunately, can't say too much else about him, but I think he's got a lot of potential just based compared to a lot of the freshmen in this league.
And the two things that UMass is going to need to augment their stars is one of the point guards to be a great penetrator, like you're saying Garcia has the potential to be. And they need their role guys to really contribute on defense, which as we come down to the wire here, takes me to my last question. Can any guy on UMass, star or role player, as we hit our timer, can anyone become a truly reliable two-way guy? And, you know, I ask the UMass fans who are listening to this, reach out to us on Twitter and tell us what you think of this. Is there anyone on this team that you truly in your heart trust on the last possession of the game, both on offense and defense? Because this team's got a lot of great offensive players. They got a lot of great defensive players. They don't particularly have a lot of two-way guys. And I think that developing that is going to be the key.
This is where I want to actually plug another freshman that I read up on a bit. I like Cairo McCorry's game quite a bit. He's a 6'5 guard, so he's got some size at his position. Don't think he's as reliable of a shooter as a lot of UMass's players, but he's versatile. He's a really good rebounder and just a good athlete in general, which I think is going to make him one of the better defenders on this team. So maybe he's not quite the answer of, like, who do you want taking the big shot late in the game, but to me, just at first glance, he looks like a guy that's good enough to play late game possessions on defense.
Yeah, and, you know, I want to wrap this up. Final note here. UMass picked up a grad transfer, 6'10", 245, Mark Gasparini. He was born in Moscow. He's 6'10", 245. I don't have anything to add to that. That just sounds terrifying.
You know, he's not going to replace Trey Mitchell, but I think, you know, best case is he's a better version of DeJerry Baptiste. But, yeah, that does sound terrifying. It's a good point.
All right, so now we move on to the team least – to the team most likely for us to not hit the 15-minute mark on, the LaSalle Explorers. They lose Ed Crosswell, who I personally thought was their best guy last year. They bring back a few interesting pieces. David Beatty's back, Scott Spencer, Christian Ray, who came on in conference play, Sharif Kenny, Jack Clark, who dealt with some injury issues, Jared Kimbrough. They also finally get some eligibility for the Indiana transfer, Clifton Moore. So, Matt, where do you want to start with this team? Because, you know, we've done this pod for 2 years, and no disrespect to the Explorers, but I've definitely watched less LaSalle in both seasons than any of the other 13 teams.
Yeah, I don't know why that happens. I guess it's okay that we went over on St. Louis. We're going to make up some of that time here. But yeah, like you said, LaSalle losing three key players, Crosswell, two guys graduated, Saul Peary and Isaiah Deese. So, you know, while there's a lot of solid guys coming back, I think the biggest question around LaSalle is who's going to be the star. David Beatty is the leading returning scorer, but he only averaged 10.7 points a game. So, you know, is he ready to be a go-to guy? I'm not quite sure yet. Overall, I think you got to give Ashley Howard credit. He's kept LaSalle out of the pillow fight in both of his seasons in the A-10. But I'm just not quite sure. Is it time for LaSalle to actually, you know, join the middle of the pack and be a threat to upset some good teams? Or are they just going to hang around where they've been the last few years?
This is basically exactly how we spent half of our LaSalle preview last year.
More or less, yeah.
There's some nice pieces here, but they don't have a star, and I'm not even particularly sure that they have a guy who would normally be a number two option. And we kept asking the question of who becomes that guy last year, and the answer was no one. They missed Pookie Powell so badly, and you know, sadly, not only did they not have a star last year, but no one particularly showed me the potential to be a star for this team. They get a high pedigree guy in Clifton Moore. He didn't play very much in his 2 years in Indiana. I would say at this point, he's probably the most likely guy, just given how well sought after he was in high school. But, you know, I just struggle to answer that question. And I guess that's really all you need to know about where LaSalle's ceiling is this year.
So let's just, I kind of, one of my main questions about this team is what can we expect out of Clifton Moore? And I don't even want to waste my time looking at his stats in 2 years at Indiana, because he basically never played meaningful minutes, and it's just not worth our time. But I went back earlier this summer, thought about writing something actually, which I never do. Didn't get around to it. But I wanted to look at what we can expect from A10 transfers from premier basketball programs. And I went back the last 6 or 7 years. And overall, I think this gives me a lot of optimism for Clifton Moore and LaSalle. You look at Dayton, they've had a lot of luck going this route. Ibby Watson from Michigan right now is a phenomenal player. Jordan Seibert from Ohio State and V. Sanford from Georgetown were both key on their Elite Eight team. Rhode Island had Stanford Robinson from Indiana. He went on to be the Defensive Player of the Year in the A-10. GW had Maurice Creek and Isaiah Armwood, two Power Five transfers on their most recent tournament team. Javon Dess from St. Louis is another really good example. He barely played in the Big Ten, went on to be all conference for
Tremaine
the
Isupel.
Dominicans. And then LaSalle, they had BJ Johnson a couple years ago. And, unfortunately, he was a part of some terrible Explorer teams. But I think just looking at those examples, even if you get a guy that didn't see meaningful minutes at a great program, that doesn't mean they can't become very good in the A-10. So while we can't say too much about what Clifton Moore did at Indiana, I'd be surprised if he was any worse than average at his position compared to the rest of the conference.
Oh, I'd be, from all I've read up on Clifton Moore, I'd be shocked if he's a below average player. Sadly for LaSalle, I think for them to get out of the pillow fight, they need him to be a lot better than just simply above average. He should be a very fun piece for them, though. I just look up and down the roster. I kind of wonder who it could be to make that leap. Christian Ray was pretty impressive in conference play last year. He entered the starting lineup late in the year, ended up, sh wow, he shot 27% from three. I thought it was better than that, but.
No, not really. Yeah, I think Christian Ray is interesting just because he's a glue guy. I mean, he's a good rebounder, even though he's only 6'6", but it feels like he has the potential to play bigger than that at times. And he's one of the few guys on this team returning that's actually good at scoring at the rim, because a lot of LaSalle's guys were just mostly jump shooters. So I am interested in Ray. I think he's got room to grow. Otherwise, we haven't really talked about Scott Spencer yet. He was one of the best 3-point shooters in the conference, and I think he's perfect as a complementary piece, but he's a guy that's never going to create for himself. He was just bad shooting inside the 3-point line in general. So someone's got to just get him the ball while he's open. I don't know, man. It's this team, I don't think they're terrible. I just don't see as much optimism compared to some of the other bad teams. Like, at least, St. Joe's is Ryan Daly. And I don't know, GW beat some good teams last year. I'm not sure what to say about this now.
Honestly, I think we're a little too down just because their floor is higher than a few other teams in this conference. Like,
Right.
the doomsday scenario for LaSalle is they still end up winning 5 or 6 games. Like, I don't, despite the overall pessimism that we're kind of displaying now and the lack of a top level guy, there's enough dudes here that I'd be stunned if they go like 3 and 15. I
Right.
think that at worst, this is a team that's going to cause some good teams problems. They're going to hang around in most of their games. They're just going to happen to lose a lot of those games that they hang around in. So I'll go to my first question, really kind of the key to LaSalle's ability to be competitive on a night-to-night basis. Can they lead the A-10 in three-pointers made this year? Because the way that they're the best path to them being successful is just jacking the ball up and shooting a ton of threes and hoping that they can outgun other teams. I expect them to lead the conference in three-pointers attempted this year, but that doesn't always necessarily lead to the most made ones. And I think for them to stay out of the pillow fight, they're going to have to be great from deep.
Yeah, if I didn't do so much research on GW last year, I would maybe say they could lead the conference, but GW is going to take an absurd amount of three-pointers. I do think three-point shooting, though, that can still be the strength of this team. As I mentioned, Scott Spencer was around 46% in conference play. He's really dangerous. David Beatty's gotten a little bit better every year, but he's still not, a great three-point shooter, although he's maybe a little bit better at creating his own threes. Other than that, I don't know. I feel like actually to me, LaSalle would be a little bit better off trying to go more well-rounded because they don't have – I mean, they lose two good shooters in Peary and Dees, so I think it's going to be kind of tough for them to have a super high volume. Although I will say Clifton Moore, I mean, even at 6'10", like, he's versatile enough where I think he can step out and shoot a little bit. So it could happen. I don't know. I mean, I guess when you live and die by the three, like, LaSalle kind of has the last few years, but that makes them dangerous on any given night, but I just don't know if it's going to lead to consistently good results.
Yeah, I feel kind of the same way. I'm not sure how well they're going to play without having lost Peary and Dees. I actually fully expect them to shoot just as many threes as they did last year. I don't see this becoming a more balanced offense, but they're going to need a guy like Christian Ray to really step up his three-point shooting. And honestly, they're probably going to need Scott Spencer to be in the top five in the conference in individual percentages to get there.
Yeah, I guess going along those lines of good three-point shooting, a guy I really wanted to talk more about, Jack Clark, who really we don't know very much about him just because he only played about 10 or 11 games his freshman season in the middle of the year, too, because he was recovering from an injury in the preseason. Then he re-injured himself later on. He's just dealt with knee injuries his whole career, which is a big shame because clearly he's got a lot of potential. I mean, I'm pulling up his stats now. He averaged 10 points a game off the bench as a true freshman, getting not a whole lot of playing time. I feel like he's kind of the Chase Johnson of this team where he's got a really high ceiling, but we just don't know what to expect because it's just like Chase Johnson for Dayton. Like, he just hasn't played enough games. But if he is healthy, I mean, he shot 41% from beyond the arc in his one season with the Explorers, and it's kind of hard to find information on LaSalle, but all signs point to him being available at the start of the season. I really think he might be the X factor just because, you know, there is so much we don't know about him. And he did show that those flashes of potential in the short time he was on the court.
Jack Clark is such a mystery that I somehow got mind tricked into forgetting which season he played those 9 games.
Yeah.
I thought it was last year. It was actually the 18-19 season.
Yeah.
He kind of had a debut quite similar to Jordan Miller that year. 10 points, 4 rebounds a game. I kind of see him following really the Jordan Miller trajectory where he's able to take another step up from those numbers this year if he is healthy. But I don't particularly see him as like the great savior of this team. Although I will say having him is really going to help them a lot.
Yeah, if he can stay on the court, that's going to be the key. And, you know, I really hope he can because it sounds like he's had a rough go of it with injuries. But it's hard to count on someone like that at the same time, which is why I'm kind of cautious with my expectations.
Yeah, so my last question here, how is this team going to be on the glass and with their interior defense too? I think there's a pretty good chance that Clifton Moore could help them offensively down low, but they lose Ed Crosswell, who is so critical shot blocking and rebounding the ball. And I'm really wondering, can the combination of Moore and Jared Kimbrough replace what Crosswell gave them in the grit areas?
Well, we can save some time because that was pretty much my last question as well. And actually, one guy I've sort of been having my eye on for what's out is one of their freshmen, Tegra Ize, a 6'10 center out of Canada, who is actually interesting. I was reading an interview he did shortly after committing to LaSalle, and it kind of sounds like they might run a system with him and Clifton Moore on the court at the same time, with Moore playing more of an outside game. And Ize, watching some of his tape, he's more of a traditional, like, back-to-the-basket center, kind of like a, I don't know, a Michael Hughes or someone, where he's not going to – he doesn't have any range, but he's going to be a good interior defender that's going to get a lot of rebounds. I think he's a guy that could help quite a bit. Jared Kimbrough, honestly, while offensively he didn't do what Crosswell did, defensively, you know, not as good of a rebounder, but I still think interior defense, he was just as good. So he's going to have to step up a little bit. But that is tough because Crosswell, especially on the offensive end, he was one of the best rebounders in the conference and in the country. So that is going to be tough to replace. And I'm interested to see what Eze does as a freshman. So I think the opportunity is going to be there for him to get some minutes.
So real quick, Michael Hughes is not a shooter. Come on. He at least believes he is.
You're right. He shouldn't be quite as much, but you're right. I should have talked about Jordy. That would have been a better comparison, maybe.
Yeah. So this actually kind of carries well into our final question. We got one from Dennis at Gipper Grove. By the way, if anyone's looking for a good LaSalle follow, I would venture to say that he is the best on Twitter right now for the Explorers. He said that there are only two seniors this year, so we'd love to hear about who's going to step up. I feel like we've really covered that. He's very pumped up about Jack Clark and how good he can be coming back from the injury. But his question is basically, can they have a legit A-10 worthy starting five? So David Beatty, definitely. Scott Spencer, yes. And all indications, Clifton Moore, yes. So we're 3/5 of the way right there. Really, Jack Clark ties into this a lot because if he's healthy, he should be number 4. And you know, there's enough potential guys that they could probably find a fifth.
Yeah, they could be. I feel confident in 3 of those guys, like you mentioned. It's just going to be filling in those gaps. One more thing before we do wrap it up with LaSalle, I want to mention, it seems like they have a solid freshman class. Eze, as I mentioned, is a 3-star recruit. Anmore Gill is a 3-star wing at 6'4". It seems like he can do a lot of things. And then Jameer Brickus is a 5'11 guard who could maybe compete with Iyandi Hakeem at the point guard spot. He's a 2,000-point scorer in high school, but maybe he can be one of those guys that provides a spark and can create shots for himself. But you're right. It's hard to be confident in this entire roster. There's some solid pieces, but it's just a matter of who's going to step up and be the leader and how is it all going to come together.
Yeah, to really be able to say yes to that question, I would say you probably need a healthy Jack Clark. I think it starts right there. And then beyond that, I think it probably comes down to one of the freshmen really, really having an impressive start of the year.
Yeah, and I think that gives LaSalle a little optimism. Having some good freshmen, I mean, if one of those guys can be all freshman team and maybe break into the starting lineup, that could be a big boost that we just don't know about yet. And that's kind of what that's where I see the most growth for LaSalle. If one of these pretty highly touted newcomers can come in and do a good job, all of a sudden that raises their ceiling quite a bit.
Yeah, and you know what? We hit the timer. So
it wasn't pretty, but we did it.
We did. We did it. We went way over on SLU, but we hope everybody enjoyed our St. Louis, UMass, and LaSalle breakdowns. We will be back on Monday again next week. Matt, who are we coming back with next week?
That is a great question. I'm pretty sure we have the Bonnies. Might have Fordham too. I don't know. You want to pick a third team right now on the spot?
I mean, you're the great keeper of the list.
Yeah,
so.
I have the list open. All right. We're going to
do. Also, we're definitely not editing this out.
Not at all. No, we'll do St. Bonaventure, Fordham, and Davidson. Let's do those three teams, no matter what the list says. That sounds good to me.
All righty then. So if you're a fan of the Bonnies, the Davidson Wildcats, or the Fordham Rams, be sure to join us next week. But you know what? Just join us anyway. Even if you don't root for those three, why not? Get some more education on the conference. We thank you guys for sitting through going way too long on SLU today. Thank you for listening once again to the 3-Bid League podcast. Be sure to give us 5 stars on iTunes. Be sure to reach out with any questions on Twitter at 3BidLeaguePod or on our email 3BidLeague@gmail.com if you got anything that you want us to answer on the pod. Matt, you got anything else to add?
Not much, man. I mean, the podcast has been back for a week. The season hasn't been canceled yet, so that's a good sign. And just here's hoping that things go smoothly once we get started in late November.
Absolutely. And we thank you guys again for listening. Be sure to tell a friend.